You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the second part of a very special episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we're going to be continuing our discussion from last time on the top 10 science fiction programs of all time. As you may recall, we discussed Newsarama's top 10 list and where we agreed and disagreed on some of those things. But of course, because we disagreed on some of those things, that means that we still have some of our own favorites that we'd like to talk to you about.
That's right.
So I guess let's just plow right back in. We should recap there. Last week, if you'll recall, we talked about their top 10, which are Quantum Leap, Firefly, Farscape, The X-Files, The Prisoner, Lost, The Twilight Zone and Outer Limits, Battlestar Galactica, the new one, Star Trek, and Doctor Who. And we've got some agreement on some of those, and we have some not so much agreement on some of those. So, I'm going to go down your list, Ben.
Oh, dear.
I'm going to go down from your, because you numbered your list. My list is not numbered, so we'll knock as many of them off using your list before we get to mine, where I have to confess that I'm just like, yeah, this is just kind of out there.
Like, okay.
I didn't have the spine to rate them from 1 to 10, except for Doctor Who and Star Trek. On your list, at number 10.
Now we're going very obscure.
This is very obscure. I'm going to go with this. I know it quite well. And that is,
I wonder why.
And that is Die Ranger. Tell us. It's on your list. It's not on mine. Tell us about it.
Well, for people who don't know what Die Ranger is, I'm sure everybody, or at least here in America, are familiar with the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers.
Yes.
Yes. I think most people also realize that this was, especially in its first year, was largely a Japanese import that got hacked together with American footage. And it involved five youths, usually four guys and one gal. That seemed to be, in most cases, the average. How they would transform into costumed, they called them Power Rangers, I guess, here in the States.
I was going to say, in Power Rangers, it was three guys, two girls.
Oh, that's right. In Power Rangers, it was three guys,
yeah,
two girls.
Yeah, they balanced it out, whereas in Japan, they only usually have the token one girl.
Right. And they all had their own little droid or Zord. It was a giant robot that could then assemble and become an even bigger, more powerful giant robot.
And make an even bigger, more powerful toy.
Right. For toy shops to sell like crazy. With the Japanese versions, they tended to be a lot darker. That
can be, yeah.
Kind of scarier in some respects. Die Ranger, for me, I thought, now I should also clarify this by saying this is the one series that I think really kind of does not fall under my rule that I mentioned in the last episode, that it has to break new ground and it has to kind of cross demographic lines and become just a huge part of the pop culture. I suppose in some ways you could say the Die Ranger did, but not in the same sense that many of my other shows did. So I was really reaching when I put this one up there. This was more of a personal choice. Die Ranger, what I really loved about this show is that it was very mythic. It was a very epic story of good versus evil, the balance of good versus evil, how that battle got carried over into what was present day and carried out through the use of giant robots.
And it wasn't a one-sided battle either.
Good lost a lot of battles. And anytime good started getting the upper hand a little bit too much, there would be yet a third force that would come in and kind of lay a smack down on both sides.
Yeah.
So it was a very dark show that dealt with some of the themes definitely had a very Japanese feel to it. I mean, there's just no way getting around it.
Yeah.
No. But I've always been a big fan of the epic story. And Die Ranger did a very good job at telling the epic story.
Okay, let me just because probably our audience, there might be some of you out there may or may not have a better grasp of these shows, but let me just give a little background. In Japan, they have what's called tokusatsu, which is a contraction of words that basically means special photography, and that means Godzilla falls under that category. It's sort of their version of special effects films. Ultraman is probably the most famous of the tokusatsu. Even in the United States, people kind of know who Ultraman is. But there are several other series, if you will. Kamen Rider, the Masked Rider, the Sentai, which is a battle team kind of people, and that's what we're talking about here. The Sentai teams, as Ben mentioned, roughly five people in motorcycle helmets and spandex costumes, multicolored, looking just exactly like you would think of the Power Rangers, because that is where the Power Rangers come from. They put out one of these shows every year since the early 70s. They put out about 52 episodes of a show. They tell one big year-long story. And they've been doing that since the 70s, long before our story arc craze in the United States. They've been doing that. And so different years, they have different themes. For example, right a couple of them before Die Ranger, there was one called Jetman, which the theme was birds are superheroes, and they are superheroes. They have superpowers. You know, had various powers of birds, condors, eagles, owls. Right before it, Jew Ranger, which is what originally was made into Power Rangers and was the prototype, were dinosaurs, because dinosaurs are cool with kids. Remember when everyone was buying Power Rangers toys and couldn't get them? You know, that was... Mm-hmm. I mean, these shows are made by Bandai. In Japan, it's legal to do that, for a toy company to make a TV show and then advertise the heck out of it. And it is concerted advertising plan. Die Ranger was based on Chinese mythology. Phoenix, Kirin,
The dragon,
the stone lion. What was the other one? Phoenix?
The phoenix.
On the dragon. Oh, you get the dragon, yeah. It's okay. The red's the dragon. It doesn't really matter. And that's what their giant robots are, and then they combine together and they fight. And it's all very ridiculous. I mean, it's all very... You'd think, oh, come on, seriously. But Ben's absolutely right. The themes are much darker. Basically, throughout the course of these 52 episodes, our heroes, every last person they love, is killed. By the end of the episode, all of their family, all of their friends, everyone they know, has died in this battle. Has been killed.
In fact, our lead ranger, the lead ranger is always red. I never really could understand that
Japanese
one.
Flag.
But we find out that his own father, in a
betrayal. He's Darth Vader.
Yeah, in what George, I think George Lucas kind of, I don't know what came first. I don't know if it was Die Ranger or
Star Wars came first, yeah.
Star Wars came first, okay.
Yeah,
so
Die Ranger definitely stole it.
So then this is a blatant ripoff of Star Wars, but still well done. And I remember when I watched the episode, I was emailing you like crazy, oh my God, the parallels here. It was a joke about how our hero's father really worked for the enemy.
There's a theme of he betrayed the previous batch of Rangers and killed them all, and went over to the bad guys, and now he's back to kill the kids, and they battle it out, and in the end,
he betrays the bad guys.
He betrays the bad guys to save his son and dies in the process. And you know exactly the thing. There's this tales of unrequited love where one of our heroes, who's generally a misanthropic person. And likes animals more than humans, falls in love with a spirited goddess of the peacock, and she is bent on revenge. He's against the bad guys. He is trying, and that's not the Buddhist way, and he is trying to turn her back to, and he's in love with her, and her hatred is killing her, and she's slow, and of course she dies before the thing over. I mean, it's just, it's depressing, and this is aimed at little kids. This is aimed at kids, and I really appreciate that, because it doesn't treat kids like they're too stupid or too fragile to know, even though it's fanciful, a real story like a fairy tale story where, you know, the woodsman gets eaten by the wolf, or, you know, all the sanitized Mother Goose tales as they are now, where they've removed all the nasty stuff, is wrong, in my opinion. I think
what happens is you have a show that, as we said, it deals with epic themes. It's very mythological in nature, and yet it touches on real life issues at this very same time, and makes them relevant, and presents these to kids. And that's one of the reasons why I think the show took on such a very dark turn. And I could not get enough of this series.
So even though it's formulaic, because it always ends with them getting together, fighting, join their robots together, have a big battle thing, I mean, that's absolutely
every
episode.
It's how they
get
to that point that I always find fascinating.
Every episode ends that way. And it is a commercial. It's a toy commercial. But at least when they put the toy commercial together, they had a little integrity to give the kids something more than just G.I. Joe or Captain Planet or some of the absolute drivel that we get over here when they're selling toys on Saturday morning anyway. So we've gone off into obscure land, but that's okay. That's why we're here. I love Die Ranger. Die Ranger is my favorite Sentai program as well. Die Ranger and Jetman. Die Ranger and Jetman are really close. Jetman is even darker than Die Ranger in some ways.
Well, especially in the very last episode, my God. Yeah, so, one of your heroes, if you will, kind of bites it.
So, but for the same reasons that they have this. Even though it's utterly ridiculous that you have monsters that are made out of a giant cup of noodles, it's they're fun.
Or a lipstick monster like you have in Die Ranger.
The lipstick monster and that. Oh yeah. So some of them are quite ridiculous.
But then it kind of plays.
It doesn't matter. You just smack them up.
There's something rather metaphorical. I think like the lipstick monster. She played on people's No, that was a mirror.
She played on vanity. She played on vanity and her. She could cause them to sing. I don't understand that one.
But there was a mirror monster that played on people's vanity.
Yes. Yep.
The monsters were corny, there was a deliberate point behind them.
Yes.
And so, in a way, you could say that there was something of an object lesson that was going on there.
Yep.
If you looked into it. I thought this was a great show.
Well, you're 9 and 8. We've already covered Lost and Battlestar Galactica, so let's move on to number 7. UFO.
UFO.
UFO, which we are currently reviewing.
Which we're currently reviewing. The reason I put this one on my list, as I've said in past episodes where we talked about UFO, I was a big Gerry Anderson fan. I loved the model work of Derek Meddings. Talk about Thunderbird, Stingray, Captain Scarlet. I mean, I thought these shows were just great fun. They're good kiddie sci-fi. Great kid sci-fi stuff. UFO, now you've got Jerry who is, for whatever his motivation was, he was making a foray into something that was serious, something that was kind of adult. He says, okay, I've done enough pandering to the little children. Now I want to pander to the adults now. And he came up with this show, which, again, as you and I have talked about, it was not so much about the aliens, it was about the people who were fighting the aliens and all the drama that takes place there. So you have this show that was kind of, I don't know if atypical is the correct word, but it didn't fall into cliche, which I thought made it a fascinating science fiction show.
Certainly, I think it's an early example of that. You know, a lot of shows now are more about, or at least they try to be more about the people than they are the actual story. I think that's, you can fall into a trap there and do it wrong. But personally, I really like UFO. I wouldn't have put it in my top 10.
I think they got it right. And again, because it, here's a show that was, it was breaking new ground and did a damn good job of doing it, in my opinion. And that's why I stuck it in my top 10. It's on my list. It rates as number 7.
Number 7. We're not going to go into it long because we've talked about UFO so much on the show. But
yeah, I really don't need to go any further on that. But I just wanted to give my reasons as to why I put it there.
Right. All right, well, you had X-Files at number 6, so we'll just skip on by that. And we'll come up to number 5. And number 5 on your list is also on my list, very high up on the list. I think, you know, it's in top 3, 4, something like that. Which, when you figure Star Trek and Doctor Who are 1 and 2, that tells you it's either 3 or 4. And I'm my mind is boggled that they didn't have it on the Newsrama. And I'm sure there are people out there who know me from many years that are going to be staggered by this, in my agreement. But Ben at 5 and me at 3 or 4, Babylon 5.
I was shocked.
Shocked that I have it there? Shocked that they don't have it there.
Well, I know why you kind of changed your tune after you got the DVD set. You told me that when you started watching episodes...
In my opinion, you have to watch Babylon 5 from front to back and not be sitting there once a week for 5 years.
For some people, I guess, yeah, that's the only way to really watch it. I had no problem watching it week to week to week. But I do agree that if you actually get to sit down with the entire series and just plow right through them, I think the show stands it's much stronger. You get a better sense of the overall integrity that Joe Michael Straczynski was trying to tell here. And
who is a pompous, arrogant? which is one of my reasons I didn't like it to begin with. But when it first aired, I thought the first year. You know, I tried watching it the first year.
First year is the weakest.
It's really the weakest.
For many people.
The character of Sinclair. I have nothing against the guy, but I just didn't think he was definitely a different kind of commander. I like the fact that he was, you know, into Tennyson and a thinking guy and whatnot, but he just didn't work.
He was almost a little too cerebral.
Glad they got rid of him, frankly.
A lot of people are.
And I think the show really improved. But I think the show really improved as they... I guess what we should mention the key thing about Babylon 5. The key thing about Babylon 5 is that it's the pioneer. It's certainly in American television. But it is the pioneer of the story arc. Prior to Babylon 5...
It really didn't have story arcs.
It didn't have it.
And Joe has gone on record of saying, and I've actually read some story Bibles, some show Bibles that he had written before it even aired. And he did make the claim, even way back when, that this was designed to be a 5-year series. Now, granted, it did take some different turns as it was going on.
Right.
So it didn't resemble quite what he had originally.
Oh yeah, I saw him
put
him
out there.
I saw him at a science fiction convention fully a year before the pilot of Babylon 5 came out, and he was this is Hill Street Blues in space. This is a novel. Told over, I don't remember that he said 5 years, but you know he definitely said that. He said those things. He wouldn't tell anybody what they were. And all right, fine. But the good or bad thing about it, why Babylon 5 is on my list, is because he did that. he achieved a 5-year arc, and it's quite clear that he wasn't making it up as he went along.
No.
He pretty much had a good idea.
He
obviously had to make some turns, and you can see things that got, you know, if you look back and you say, okay, that had to have been twisted, or maybe that was going to be this other character. But nonetheless, the unlike Lost and Battlestar Galactica and many of the other shows that I complain about, including new Doctor Who, where they just, you know, make episodes that don't make any sense unless you take them standing with all the other stuff of the series. The stuff that's put into the Babylon 5 episodes fits with the episode, you know, as let's say, background or storytelling, and you don't see it as being the hammer hitting you on the head, saying this is important later on. A conversation that the commander will have with a general back on Earth, or, you know, some little news piece that's running on a screen in the background, or feed, or some gossip that people are talking about at the cafeteria during the day, 2 years later becomes important. And not necessarily important like you had to have known that or the story won't make sense, but that when that comes up, you go, yeah, they were talking about that 2 years ago. It lent a feel that it was actually a thought-out, cohesive universe. And, you know, not taking into account the fourth and fifth series, where they had to speed up the conclusion because the show had been axed and then brought back on another network for the fifth season. And so Straczynski, I think, you know, threw in some stuff that he trimmed out, and all the Centauri stuff and the neck parasites. But even that had been foreshadowed in earlier episodes with the whole Jakar with a one-eye patch will strangle Londo, and all that stuff was actually foreshadowed in the program. I just think it would have played out differently in the fourth and fifth seasons.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. So I would have loved to have seen how the series... in fact, we already know that all of season four would have been about the Shadow War had it not been canceled, and then all of season five was going to be about the Earth Civil War. Instead, he had to literally just cram all those things in, and he did make the statement, I did read it on the Usenet, that if push came to shove and he did lose a fifth season, that he could tell his story in 4 years. It could be done. He didn't want to do it that way, but he had a means to do so.
Well, I think he had A, B, and C threads there. I mean, he had the Earth Civil War, he had the Shadow War, and he had the Centauri, whatever you want to call it.
He had a Centauri conflict kind of figured out, but that was, I think, when he saw that was along with the telepaths. Those were going to be just backstories, and then thought, oh, well, now I've got this fifth year. Okay, well, now I guess I can pull these things. I'll blow the dust off of them and do something.
He had to cut them out of the other one to cram everything in the fourth year, and then so now you get basically backstories. Yeah, the telepath war was the other one.
I think you're right. What really set this show apart is that, okay, take the changes, you know, whatever story arc changes in direction that Joe had to take. Forget the fact that the show got prematurely canceled and then renewed to another channel.
He dealt with them well. Network. He dealt with his.
He rolled with it really, really well, and for the most part, he still had his 5-year plan. And we know that because that's what he kept talking about even before we had the pilot. He kept talking about this 5-year plan, and he executed it, and that's why these stories stand up as well as they do.
I think they stand up because just because somebody making a TV show says, I have a 5-year plan, does not mean he really has a 5-year plan. But whatever he produced in the end came off looking like he did. How about that? You know, the proof is in the pudding, not the proof is in the fact that he's been telling us that all along. Because he's, you know, like anyone, you have to sell these things, and I'm not necessarily.
I think you're right. I would dare say that he probably did have a 5-year plan, and that it was, for the most part, largely figured out. And I think the evidence is in what was finally produced.
The other thing I liked about Babylon 5 was it was a very nice, cohesive universe that he put together. Reasonably scientifically accurate, you know. No real sound in space. That was the music. You know, nice little touches like if you blow up an alien ship, the explosion's a different color because they breathe a different atmosphere.
Right.
The whole commercial system on Babylon 5. It was all very well thought out and internally logically consistent universe, which is something I can't say for Star Trek.
No.
And that was another good thing about Babylon 5. But I do think that you're better off seeing it as a whole than you are stringing it over a long period of time. But I also think that you could safely say that you can look at Babylon 5 as one big novel. You can look at Babylon 5 as 5 different novels in a 5-story set. And you can look at each of those as a collection of short stories. And it works at every level.
Yes, it does.
And that earns it a place on the list, in my opinion. That is an accomplishment in television that I don't think has been equaled in that respect.
And unfortunately...
And very difficult to do with television, because how do you get a 5-year commitment to do a show? You don't. That's a tough call.
So then don't do a 5-year commitment. Do a smaller commitment, do a 1-year commitment, or push for a 2-year commitment, and then if you get if all of a sudden you find, oh, I've got more years, okay,
then you have
to
pad it out.
Well, but no, think about, okay, well, I don't necessarily, okay, like with Babylon 5, Joe had this finale that when we reach it, that's it. There's nothing left. That clearly kind of separates Babylon 5 out from other television shows.
You could do what
Enterprise, Star Trek Enterprise tried to do. Unfortunately, they did it. It was too little, too late. And that is, if you want to do story arcs, do mini story arcs. Don't do these big, you know, series long, big, multi-year story. But do a whole bunch of montage of smaller story arcs that maybe last over, oh, say, a month. Something like that.
Anyway, last thing I want to say about Babylon 5 before we move on. Spake's archaeology. I love that aspect. It's not used much in the course of the series. But I love that idea. That as we push out into space,
we find dead civilizations
of alien life. And, you know, we have teams that go out and dig them up and
IPX.
Try to either learn about them or
exploit
the technology that we can learn. I love that idea.
They explore it more in the sequel series, you want to call it, Crusade. They do go more into that.
Yeah,
it's still a great idea that they
have. It's not original to them. There are classic science fiction books that went to that area, but I love the idea.
But I'm glad that he showed it.
Yes, I think that's exactly what we'd do. We'd exploit what we could find.
We would do that. It's perfectly logical. Of course we're going to want to explore, especially when you consider that humans were kind of one of the younger races. You've got all these other alien races that are far older, far more powerful, far more technologically advanced. Of course you want to get a leg up. So what do? You go out, you study dead civilizations and see what you can learn.
That's right. All right, so let's move on to your number 4. And basically probably my number 3, which would put Babylon 5 at number 4. Blake 7.
I'll let you start off on this one.
All right, Blake 7. I love Blake 7. I think Blake 7, a lot of the things we just said about Babylon 5, I think we can say about Blake 7.
I agree.
The story of 7 outlaws on the run against the evil... Galactic Federation. In an amazing spacecraft. What sets Blake 7 apart in my mind, and I like that. I mean, they're standalone episodes, but there are a few kind of weaving themes like the search for Star One and the the search for Blake, and the and let's ha- there's the period of time when Blake's gone. It's like, let's make some money, doing some pirating, the whole thing. And what makes Blake Seven is characterization, and dialogue. It's Terry Nation's brainchild. It's got some of the funnest dialogue I've ever seen in a show. Some of the characters, many of the characters, but particularly Caraven and Villarestel, have so many quotable lines as to be almost comical, that there's just so much to do. And they are fascinating characters and generally internally consistent. And it makes up for all the dodgy special effects and the sets that make Doctor Who sets look good. And I love the show. It's a great show.
I really don't have much else to add to that. I found it to be entirely compelling. There was a little bit of a simplicity to it, but that's not a criticism. Too many science fiction shows, they kind of get mired with in the way that they tell the stories, and there was something rather streamlined in the storytelling. Yes, the sets, the production values of the show were very cheap, but we're talking BBC
late 70s.
All you got to do is look at any other sci-fi show from that time, and you can see Blake Seven was no different. But what really sold the show is you had the most fascinating ensemble. I love good ensemble shows, and this was it. It had a fantastic ensemble. Even though it was called Blake Seven, everybody kind of...
It's Avon Seven.
It became Avon Seven, especially when Blake kind of went away. And Avon took over the show. Paul Darrow, just an amazing, amazing performance. I mean, he's something of a very snarky anti-hero almost. Just, who was really in it for himself. The only
And if he said he was going to shoot you...
He's going to shoot you.
He'll shoot you.
Yeah, he had no reservation in doing so. The only thing that I only had one small criticism about this. What I loved about the show when it first started is, of course, you've got this battle against this evil Galactic Federation. What I liked is that the Galactic Federation was this entity. It was a government. And you have these rebels. It's six humans, and the seventh character is actually a computer. That's there. Thereby, you have Blake Seven.
Zen.
Here they are, Zen. Here they are fighting this evil government. As the show went on, it became personified in their leader, Servalon. And it became more about Blake Seven versus Servalon. Later, she pretends to die, and won't go into the specifics on that, but then takes on this other identity of Commissioner Sleer, but it's still Servalon, and everybody knows it.
No. Not everybody knows it.
Well,
I mean, anyone in the people. Federation who figures out who she is dies. She kills them.
The audience knows it,
yeah.
And everybody in our rebel crew, they know it.
Right.
So the important people know it, that Servalon is Sleer, Sleer is Servalon. But still, you have our heroes now versus this individual and maybe anybody that she's got in her employ. So it kind of took some of that mystique out. I like the idea of it being the Seven versus this big nebulous body. I found that far more interesting as a story. It not quite so interesting when Servalon came in, but at the same time, it didn't really take away from the overall series that much. It was still fun to watch because you had a really great cast of actors, for the most part, and some of the most witty writing and dialogue, as you said, that it helped to elevate the show to something that it ends up in the top 10 because it became very memorable. everybody that I know who actually invested the time to watch this show.
Yeah, first two or three episodes, you kind of got to get going.
You have to really stick it out. Give it the 3-episode test. If you can get through the first 3 episodes, you'll really start to hang in there. And everybody who does ends up walking away saying this has got to be one of the best science fiction shows on television, period.
Now, one thing we should say, you know, we compare it to Doctor Who in the late 70s and early 80s, and that's true, obviously both made by the BBC. But there is a difference. Doctor Who was made by the children's television department. And Blake Seven was made by their drama department.
Right.
It was their, I wouldn't say exactly necessarily first attempt, but it may be their first attempt at a serious adult science fiction program.
And it shows.
Even though, you know, it's exactly the same technology and set design people and many of the same writers, many of the same production crew from various times throughout Doctor Who's era work on this show. And, you know, if the TARDIS appeared on the set of The Liberator, it wouldn't look out of place. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, they are made for a different audience, and they deserve, it deserves its place.
I agree.
On program. And that is your...
That's my list.
And that's your list, because you have Outer Limits, Star Trek, and Doctor Who for your top 3. So now I want to talk about... if you've been counting correctly, you will see that I only have 2 left. 2 slots left to fill. So I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm going to fill 1 slot with a couple, much as they did with the...
Twilight
and Outer Limits. That's their cheat. But first, let's talk about one that's a little... this is alphabetically. I would not have put this program in the list if they hadn't put The Prisoner. The Prisoner is pseudo-science fiction. It's kind of borderline science fiction. And so... so also falls The Avengers, which not only is it in my top 10 science fiction shows, but I put it as one of the top 5, my top 5 TV shows. Now, I'm not saying, you know, this is like the greatest television ever made, but
it was damn good.
Me, my personal 5 favorite TV shows are all on this list, and The Avengers has to go. Into this list. It is, of course, a sort of spy show, more so in its earlier incarnation with Dr. Keel, not Dr. Keel, Dr. something or other. it's like, you know, the guy and it's gone. Kathy Gale, as played by Honor Blackman. But really, for Americans, The Avengers started with the arrival of Emma Peel, as played by Diana Rigg.
Diana Rigg.
And, of course, John Steed is Patrick McNee, is the recurring component throughout the show. Why is it science fiction? Cybernauts. Computers killing people. What else did we have? The electric... the guy who could wield powers of electric. The people who were faking the invaders of Mars.
The house that Jack built.
The house... Oh.
One of my favorite episodes.
That's a twisted episode, I have to say. But
I love that one.
But again, what makes this show? Patrick McNee and Diana Rigg. Diana Rigg is so amazing in this program.
There aren't enough words.
There's not a word to describe how beautiful she is.
Oh, she was
how
stunning.
Competent she is. What an amazing character. How, you know, playful, brilliant, accomplished.
She was a good equal to Steed.
She was an excellent equal to Steed. And we should say that Kathy Gale was a heck of an equal to Steed in her time. But Honor Blackman is not a patch on the beauty or the lithness or the fighting ability of Emma Peel. And
yeah.
Not to take away from Kathy Gale, but she's lesser known. I have the full set of DVDs, and they're wonderful. They're less science fiction-y. That was really a turn that went on. But if only for the 2 years of the Avengers with Emma Peel and John Steed, I would say that the show deserves a place in my top 10, if you can call it a science fiction program, and I do. So we didn't talk about the show itself. It's a terribly clever, witty, sophisticated humor, and yet the plots are good. It was just a very
intelligent show.
It's a great show. It's a great show. It has to be in the.
And at no point did I ever feel that whatever the plot that they were going through. At no point did I kind of say, "Oh my God, that is just so convoluted." No, I mean,
they get a little silly when Tara came along.
But as the stories went on, I thought, you know, okay, far-fetched perhaps, but it never. It never made me kind of walk away thinking, oh, come on. It was just so well played out. And I guess what helped is just the way Steed and Emma Peel would react to those situations, how they would handle whatever plot complication was thrown their way. They handled it in such a way that it never ventured into the absurd.
So yeah, Avengers definitely on the list, and I'm fully and expecting, anticipating, and in fact at this point I'm saying I'm challenging you. I'm expecting some feedback from Simon on this one, because I know he has strong feelings about the Avengers. It may not be the same as the views just expressed with regards to Emma Peel and Kathy Gale, if nothing else. But anyway. And so we come to the last slot, and I would put these at the bottom of the top 10 science fiction shows, and I'm going to say both of these will be controversial, and there will people who will just go, you are nuts, but I will tell you why. The first is the fifth of my all-time favorite TV shows, which I will tell you now, are Star Trek, Doctor Who, The Avengers, Blake 7, and The Wild Wild West.
The Wild West.
The Wild Wild West is... why is it science fiction? Because it's steampunk.
Yeah,
it's the original
steampunk.
And, again, it's a spy program with a lot of science fiction elements in it.
It didn't make my list, but I would agree with what you just said, and it had a terrific, terrific cast.
It did, and the fact that the two men hated each other. Well,
they did. They really?
They did not get along well at all.
You wouldn't have guessed.
Ross Martin was an auteur. He was a concert violinist. He spoke several languages. He was a high IQ intellectual. A very accomplished man, and he did all his own makeup. He was a writer. He was a singer.
He was a Renaissance man.
He was a Renaissance man, and Bob Conrad.
It's not.
Was no Bob Conrad, and I like him. You know, was a rough and tumble, bandy
action
little guy.
Hero.
That's what he was like in real life. He hung out with the stunt crew all the time. They were his pals. They played football and boxing between the takes. You know, some of the leading ladies would say, you know, he stunk because they were just constantly sweating between takes. He did almost all of his own stunts in the show because he was a really tough and active guy. Ross Martin and was envious of the fact that he was the star and felt it should be a little bit more. I wouldn't say they hated each other, but I mean, they didn't hang out. Let's put it that way. And
they were buds.
They definitely did not run in the same circles or, you know, apart from There were some issues with, you know, should this person be getting as many lines? You know, I'm the star, but no, it's an ensemble. I should get some of this stuff, or I should fight. And but you don't see it on screen. On screen, the pair are a great team. They
were able to put their whatever differences they had, they were able to put them aside quite well, because it did, how many years did it last?
Five.
It's pretty respectable.
4 or 5 years.
I mean, I know they made the transition from black and white into color.
Yep. And they went, you know, the show had a very troubled history, injuries and violence accusations. It was one of those shows that really got, they had to count punches because of, at times, because of anti-violence movements on TV. They had, the networks didn't know what to do with the show. You know, at times it would be very straight Western spy show, and then other times it would go into these fantasy realms, and you'd
I think that's the very reason why I didn't put it on my list, because it was, I don't call it inconsistent, but that's it.
Yeah, it did come and go, and it played with, you know, how the executives played and how they felt that they needed to. They just didn't know what to make of it at the studios, and the fact that it was popular meant they kept recommissioning it, but they just didn't know how to do it. But is science fiction, by definition, taking what we think will happen in the future and extrapolating forward? Can you make the same argument about steampunk, where you go back in time and then extrapolate forward? You know, what if they had invented television, or what if they had invented robots? Or
I would agree. I would say if that's the qualifications, then I would say yes, you're right. I mean, my high school English teacher would tell me that. Yeah, okay. That you would be right on that.
So, you know,
so in that respect, yes, it would qualify.
So I put it there because it was a fun show with a great cast and some very interesting ideas on how you would have applied some of that technology. It, you know, it's a very James Bondian thing.
And it had the greatest, in my opinion, recurring villain.
Oh, Count Mansepi.
What?
Victor Bono. Dr. Schubert.
No, Schubert. I'm thinking Dr. Loveless.
Oh, yes, Michael Dunn.
Alexander Dunn.
Quite a Renaissance man.
Who I think he, you know, for anybody who knows who Alexander Dunn is, I mean, he was, everybody should know
starters,
him.
He's a midget.
He was a midget. He was in Plato's Stepchildren on Star Trek. And he, for a little guy, every time he was on the screen, he commanded it. I mean, it didn't matter. He really would turn out one heck of a performance. And he made evil look fun, in my opinion. He really did. Just a great character.
All right, well, last, and I guess since it's at the end of the list, we'll call it least. And this one is also going to be a little bit controversial. I'm going to have to make a qualification on it. I am talking about, whereas you picked UFO, I chose Space 1999 in its first year only.
Oh, absolutely, its first year only.
Now, Space 1999, another Gerry Anderson, this time Martin Landau, Barbara Bain, mid, like 75, something like that?
About 75, 76.
I think we discussed this on one of the UFO episodes. They didn't like the tea in the Midlands. And he said to them, you know, if you renew the show, I'll just blow up the planet in the first episode. And
we want more fighting on the moon and stuff like that.
Space 1999 was that. Very first episode, the moon is blasted out of the Earth's orbit. As far as we know, the planet's, you know, going to be destroyed without a moon, and off it goes, strictly moon-based. Now, Derek Meddings is no longer in charge of special effects there. It's Trumbull? No, it's not. Brian... wow. Can't think of it. Somebody will probably correct me on that one. But anyway, the special effects are, to be fair, much better than the special effects in UFO. The Eagle models and the space stuff are some of the most beautiful space scenes ever committed. I mean, space is colorful, space is pretty. The Eagles are, I wish they didn't make noise, but they do. And it's what I like about, of course, it's the story of the people stranded on the moon as they try to survive and find a new home. What I found interesting about it when I was a kid was that it was in space, which, you know, was my criteria for being a good show. It had lasers, it had spaceships, and they were in space. Rewatching it many years later as an adult when the DVDs came out.
I got the name. Martin Bauer.
Martin Bauer is, yes, that's
the guy's name who did the effects.
Yes.
Along with Brian Johnson.
Brian Johnson, that's the other one. That was the Brian. Okay.
Anyway.
Coming back at it as an adult. No, the criticism of Space 1999 and the rightful criticism of the first season of Space 1999, a lot of people, my dad included, because it'd be the only person I really discussed it with, everybody else I discussed it with was at school and was the same age as me, and our critique was, it's in space, it's cool, and they shot that alien. But you know, I could sit there and with my dad, and he would say, well, that story just doesn't make any sense, son. I mean, that's a pretty poor story. And you watch it as an adult, and I'm not going to say my dad was wrong, but I understand where he was coming from, because the stories don't end well. They don't answer the questions. And I know I may have been complaining earlier about them just throwing stuff out there and, you know, just to tease the audience, to make you come back later. But they didn't do that in Space 1999 because we didn't have that story arc. When they put a mystery out there, what they were trying to do, and I don't think I'm reading too much into this, I'm not trying to overanalyze it, but I'm pretty sure that this was intentional. I think it's fairly obvious. Is to show the mystery of space.
Yes.
The mystery of exploration. We are going to pass these planets. We're going to go very quickly. We're not going to have time to figure it out. And there's a lot of stuff going on out there, and we just don't know what it is. And you, as the audience, have to accept that premise, that what you're watching is the story of how they survive through that mystery, as opposed to how they solve that mystery.
I would agree with all of that, except for one episode only.
Except for one episode only. So if you can take it at that level, if you can say this is about getting through the mystery, then Space 1999 becomes a very kind of bold program. It's got a amazing visual style. The cinematography on it is very innovative. It's very European. It doesn't look like anything else that's been done. They spent time on it. This is not just slap up the cameras, take your shot, and move on to the next blocking. Somebody took time to create strange effects with the way that they've set the shots up, and it shows, and it's beautifully shot. It's not the best acted of the bunch, considering the caliber of Martin Landau and Barbara Bain. Barry Morse, probably the standout, frankly, in the show, of the characters. I wouldn't say it's the best acted program out there, but it certainly
didn't need to be.
No, but it would have been nice.
I kind of think that maybe that there was a certain sterility in the way that they all acted, and I think that added to the overall tone of the show. I don't think that was planned. I think that was just a byproduct, but it ended up working. It kind of left you with this, because you made the point that it's about the mystery of space. Well, space is cold. And the set design, there was something very spacious, very sterile, very cold about it. You didn't have a lot of warm colors. You got these very flat performances, which helped emphasize the coldness just in tone. So to me, it ended up just becoming, I loved the first season.
And you know, the funny thing is, and of course they brought in Fred Freiberger, who had been a producer on Star Trek, to try to boost the ratings and make the show more popular in America, and he positively destroyed it.
He just
turned it into an utterly stupid, practically Man from Atlantis level stupid program.
It almost became a Monster of the Week episode.
It did become a Monster of the Week episode, and it was a second attempt to recreate Star Trek by somebody who didn't know how to recreate Star Trek, and so they ruined it. And the funny thing is, when I was a kid, I liked the second season better.
I was the same way.
You know, it's like, oh, cool,
it was
more colors and more flashy,
and they run
around and blow stuff up and stuff, and they got that guy who's a miner underneath the moon. They got mines under the moon and all that cool stuff.
But when I became an adult, I went back and watched some of the first season episodes, and in fact, there are some real standouts in that first year that I thought were just brilliant, and one that I love, and I could just watch it over and over again. The moon base Alpha. The moon is traveling. It's approaching a black hole.
Collision course.
Collision course. I think that's what it's called. And it gets just downright strange.
Oh, that's the one where they actually pass through the black hole, and
yes,
they talk to the universe, and
yeah, the universe is somehow, and they
and that's what the Koenig does. His he's captured by the alien on the ship. Okay, so at the beginning of that episode, they blow up some. They're going to collide with something, isn't it? Oh, wait, maybe that's the other one. There's two episodes kind of like it. There was one where Koenig, they're using nuclear charges to alter the course of the moon, and they get past one obstacle, and then there's a bigger, worse obstacle. And I thought that was the
It's all about the black hole, and they evacuate many people, many of the moon base crew.
Right.
They take off in a whole fleet of eagles. And one of the things that's really amazing is, as the eagles were flying in the opposite direction, you're seeing all these people inside, and they're all very remorse because they're leaving whatever few loved ones they still have back on the moon. And the moon is, even though Barry Morris's character has created this energy shield.
That might survive, yeah.
That might, as it gets closer, it'll actually draw power, it'll draw strength from the black hole to strengthen the shield. So there was the thought that maybe it might survive, but still, you know, our friends and family, you know, they just may die. And as they're just going off, you see them fade into nothing. They just disappear. We don't know why. They just did. And then we see Moonbase actually go into the black hole, and there's this whole weird time dilation thing.
Very 2001.
It's very 2001. You don't know what's going on.
And then
you see Koenig and Barry Morris's character, whose name I cannot remember all of a sudden.
Dr. Bergman.
Yes, Dr. Bergman. You know, they see them very old, talking to this female voice that they question, "Are you God?" And then next thing you know, they're out of it, and all of a sudden the eagles
come back.
Are coming back, and apparently they've, without even realizing, they've done this incredible full circle. We don't know why, but that's just one of those incredible mysteries of space that you just have to kind of say, you know, wow.
Yeah, a little mystical storytelling on that one, but yeah.
But it was still fascinating storytelling.
The other one that I was thinking of, I was going to mention, is the other episode where they're going to collide. It's with a planet, is what it is. So they get out of the way of the first one, and then they're going to hit a planet. So they're going to do the whole thing again. And Alan Carter goes out and has some sort of accident and disappears. And then Koenig's out, and they find a spaceship, and he lands on the spaceship, and he meets this old woman. And she tells him, you know, don't do anything. You've got to let the moon collide with the planet. Because that will cause us to transcend into the next plane of existence. And there's Alan has also been talked to by this woman. And of course everyone thinks Koenig's is nuts. Fair enough.
What else is new?
You know, he says, we're just gonna go ahead and collide with that thing. It's like,
what? Are
sorry,
you crazy?
What? And of course he he and Alan have to stage a coup and whatnot. But for example, in that episode, there's a sequence where Koenig and Alan are running down the corridors and they meet each other, and they're talking to each other, we think. Because whenever Koenig is talking, the camera is on Alan. And whenever Alan is talking, the camera is on Koenig. And it creates this weird effect as if their minds are talking to one another. You can't actually tell if they're speaking or if they're mind-thinking back and forth to each other. And it's like, somebody... You just wouldn't learn that in film school, necessarily.
It's
innovative.
It's very bold storytelling. Very innovative.
And so... You know, those are the things that I like about Space 1999. There are flaws to it, but it was a worthy attempt, and that's really where it ends up on my list. Finally, is that it's for that reason alone. Even though, you know, it's not a well thought of TV series, I think people should go back and look at it again. Because I think now audiences probably were not ready for it in 1975, you know, in a strange sort of way.
I thought I heard something about how the series was being remastered.
They did remaster it. They did a beautiful job for the DVD release, and then apparently they did an even more beautiful job for the Blu-ray release.
Yeah, I really want to get that.
And I'm tempted to replace my DVDs with the Blu-rays, because it is one of the
prettiest.
It's
a beautiful-looking show.
It's a beautiful-looking show. And it well worthy of the effect. Well, I think that's it for our... That's our list. Listeners, if you're still with us...
Let's hear yours.
Let's tell us which ones we missed, or why ours didn't belong on the list, or whatever the case may be.
For all we know, you might introduce us to a show that we've never heard of before, that after watching it, maybe we'll say, you know, maybe it does deserve to be on that list. But yes, please, if you've got a list of your top 10 that doesn't jive with what we've shared,
then please
share it with us.
Oh, wait.
Yeah, then it's wrong.
But yes, please share it. And so we'll leave you. Doctor Who is... Well, by the time you hear this, Doctor Who will have been back on the air.
Woo-hoo!
So we're looking forward to killing Hitler.
That's right.
And hope you'll join us again next time on Fusion Patrol.
End of line.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast, a production of Lone Locust Productions. Join us on our new discussion forums at FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, username Fusion Patrol. You can also send us feedback by email at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. If you'd like to support Fusion Patrol, please leave us a review on iTunes. Fusion Patrol's theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.